All right, Tom. Yeah, so this was an article in the New York Times that I came across over the weekend. I think it ran sometime last week. The headline really says it all, which is what researchers discovered when they sent 80,000 fake resumes to U.S. jobs.
That was Matt Kelly. This is Tom Fox, and I'd like to welcome you to the award-winning Compliance Into the Weeds, the only podcast to take a deep dive, literally going into the weeds on a compliance or compliance-related topic each week. This week, Matt and I take a deep dive into a study about workplace discrimination in the hiring process, and we tease out lessons for the compliance professional about centralizing your compliance function in a corporate office and how that might be a more efficient way for compliance to operate. It's a fascinating story. First, we're going to have a word from our sponsor, Ethico.
In the delicate arena of compliance, every conversation matters. Traditional methods can leave callers feeling unheard, but Ethico changes the game. Our empathetic interview technique reshapes compliance calls into powerful, compassionate interactions, ensuring no crucial detail is missed. It's about creating a conversation that matters, that resonates, that makes a difference. Be the change in your compliance approach. See the transformation for yourself at ethico.com/CPN. Book a demo, try our free ROI calculator, and explore the white paper by Tom Fox, The ROI of Compliance.
Hello, everyone. This is Tom Fox back again with Matt Kelly for another episode of the award-winning Compliance Into the Weeds. Welcome back, Matt.
Hello, Tom. Good to be here.
Matt, you had an article catch your eye. I don't want to say we're taking hot takes on current events, but an article in the New York Times about hiring and AI, and you drew some really interesting compliance lessons from it. You blogged, of course, about it, so I was hoping maybe we might be able to explore that today. Could you set the stage for us?
All right, Tom. Yeah, so this was an article in the New York Times that I came across over the weekend. I think it ran sometime last week. The headline really says it all, which is what researchers discovered when they sent 80,000 fake resumes to U.S. jobs. And so this is a paper that is being published sometime soon, or has already been published, I think, by three business professors who, as the headline suggests, they conjured up 80,000 fake resumes to do a test of hiring discrimination at large U.S. companies. So 80,000 resumes, all of the experience is essentially identical. What they had changed was the identity of the fake resume applicant. So some names were male, some names were female, some names were traditionally white sounding, I guess like Conrad Smith or something like that. Some names were more black sounding. Some of the resumes were for people who were clearly older, over the age of 40. Some of them were younger. Some of the resumes had distinctions that clearly indicated the applicant would be gay or bisexual or something. And some left no hints at all as to the resume's sexual orientation. So they sent out these resumes, 80,000 of them, to 100 companies, large U.S. companies, that had advertised, I think it was a total of 10,000 jobs over 3 years, 2019 through 2021. And these were all entry-level jobs that in theory anybody could apply for. And the test was we send these resumes out. Then we track who gets a call back from the company. And do the companies then have this pattern of favoring one group over another? And unfortunately, listeners might not be surprised to hear that, yes, there were discriminatory patterns in some of the responses. Broadly speaking, among the whole group, it seemed that white-sounding names got callbacks and interest about 9.5% more often than black-sounding names. There were some other smaller discrepancies. Somewhat to my surprise, across the whole group, there was not that much of a favoring of male or female applicants either way, although some industries did have some gender biases. I think it was manufacturing was more often to call up male employees. Apparel was more likely to call up female employees. They did not necessarily find any interesting discriminatory patterns based on age or sexual orientation, which was, okay, unusual to me. I unfortunately thought that we would have seen some, but I'm glad to hear that we didn't see any. But Tom, the thing that stuck out for me, and that is, I think, most relevant for compliance officers, is companies that had a centralized HR function were less likely to have discriminatory patterns in which resumes got a callback compared to companies where the individual hiring manager was the one making the callback. When that was the case, there were more patterns of discriminatory hiring or discriminatory interest, I should say. But the centralized HR function, that was the single biggest criteria to suggest your company would not have a high pattern of discrimination in your hiring interests. And we can go on from there about why I think that is important and telling. But that was the big study that had been done and that the New York Times was writing about.
So that really leads to actually where I wanted to go with this, because let's explore the lessons for a centralized HR and then maybe see if we can expand that out to compliance, because I think it's bears some discussion, because it may be counter to some of the things at least I have been talking about for quite some time in terms of operationalizing your compliance. So why is a centralized HR a little bit better than having the frontline HR or other persons involved in the communications around a potential hiring?
Sure. So first, just to help listeners understand, how did the researchers figure this out? They tracked and recorded the voicemails from whoever received these fake resumes and then was interested and called up the fictional candidate and left a voicemail for them. But anyways, they then tracked, was this coming from a centralized office, probably because it had a generic corporate phone number that you could match up with the company, versus, say, an individual manager's phone number, which might be his or her cell phone or direct line or something. But Tom, I'm actually not that surprised, because when you think about it, a central HR function is staffed by people who are trained in anti-discrimination policy and procedure. They are thinking through how to be more cognizant of bias and anti-discrimination compliance. And also, they're under less pressure to hire candidates right away. I'm sure there is some pressure, but a centralized HR function is just more thinking, how do I keep the pipeline rolling? Now, an individual manager is probably thinking that I have an opening that I need to fill right now. So I'm going to have to hire somebody immediately. And the researchers even noted that in the voicemails that they heard that came from individual managers, it was often something like, the manager was very busy, he was very frantic, can you start tomorrow? When can you come in? I really need to get this filled. There was an urgency there. And my theory would be that even though those frontline managers, I'm sure that they were trained in anti-discrimination policies and procedures, and I am sure that the vast majority of them probably are not thinking, I want to discriminate, but they're probably under a lot of pressure, and they probably aren't as professionally trained as the central HR people. So they are looking for shortcuts. And if it's a manager who is a man in a heavy manufacturing industry, he's thinking, well, I know I need somebody who's going to be easy to train. I kind of sort of know what I like. I know the person has to be able to handle physical equipment. And I suspect that they just default to thinking that must be a man. And likewise, if you are, I think Ann Taylor was one of the companies that was in this sample group, or their parent company, Ascena Retail. Like, if you are a woman who is a district manager for 3 or 4 retail stores that cater to women, you would automatically then probably by default have an image of, I need a female sales clerk for my customers. You know, I don't necessarily know how upset I am over either of those kind of defaults. To a certain extent, they might make sense. You know, you'd want somebody who is in your retail store kind of reflecting the customers you get and so forth. But my point is just, people who are individuals who are looking to hire, they're going to have different pressures and different mindsets about how to get the job done than a centralized HR function, who do have a different set of pressures and experiences about how to get the job done. And they don't even see the job as the same thing. Central HR, the job is to keep the talent pipeline flowing freely. a manager, the job is to get somebody on the floor right now because that's what I'm being paid to do. And from there, you have a whole lot of biases that can creep in, that you can snuff out in different ways. But I think that's where the gap comes from.
So there's two things I'd like to explore in all of that, Matt. The first one comes from training with the terms targeted and effective training, because you make clear in your blog posts that HR professionals in the central office or the home office or the corporate office have had training in anti-discrimination, but so have the frontline folks. So does this speak to a need for greater, more effective, targeted training to the frontline folks? The second point is, you made in your blog post, was segregation of duties. Do we need to segregate these duties because of some inherent bias that we cannot overcome with robust policies and procedures and targeted and effective training on it?
Well, yeah. So my thought was that, you describe it as segregation of duties. And later on in my blog post, so did I. But I think first and foremost, it was just not just have good policies and procedures, because these are large companies, and I'm sure they had good policies and procedures for everybody. But how can you have an organizational structure that supports the policies and procedures? And one way to do that would be to have a centralized function executing those policies and procedures. So if you have a centralized HR function that is far removed from the daily pressures of filling the floor, with the requisite number of employees, they will have more time and more ability and more freedom to focus on, let's not engage in discriminatory hiring, even if we're doing that by accident, even if we're only doing it subconsciously. And the structure there of a centralized HR function would allow that extra awareness. There isn't even going to be the opportunity to engage in high-pressure hiring that will allow for these bad habits, even if they're subconscious, because these are not the same people who are out on the front lines, who are subject to those hurry up right now sort of pressures. And that was my point, is that whenever possible, could you also have a strong structure in your organization to be able to support the policies and procedures and the compliance management goals that you have? That's a more pedestrian way of saying segregation of duties, which, the financial compliance people worried about Sarbanes-Oxley compliance, they've thought segregation of duties for 20 years. And they're thinking more about how can we avoid ways to short circuit good financial reporting. I mean it more in ways to avoid bad habits in compliance practices, whether that is hiring or others. And we can talk about the others shortly. And I don't think there are very many frontline managers at large companies that are looking and eager to discriminate. I don't think that's true. But I do think that they are under certain pressures that would let them default to certain views or bad habits that would then manifest as discriminatory hiring practices. And that's not good. But training and policy will only take you so far. You need to think about, are there other structural ways we could build our organization to make sure that really doesn't happen at all? And a centralized HR function is one way to get at it when we're talking about hiring.
Well, let's just move to some of the lessons that you drew for a wider corporate remit than simply HR. And you talked about compliance, you talked about procurement, you talked about internal audit and some others. And I guess there, I certainly see the advantage of a centralized function, but I and others have talked about you need to push this down to a front line in a three lines of defense operationalization. And does this run contra to that, or is there some middle ground I'm missing?
I would say that they run complementary to each other. And it's a fair point to say that training and corporate culture do matter, but so does structure. And if you have one, if you're strong on one without the other, you're probably still not in a very good place. You need to be strong on both. But, let me just tick through some of the ways that you could think about this beyond HR and hiring discrimination. You could have a centralized procurement function, and that would reduce the risk of dealing with sketchy third parties or unreliable suppliers, because procurement is better at finding good, solid, reliable, and potentially even low corruption, ethical suppliers. You could have a centralized IT team that would help to reduce your privacy and security risks, since they are going to be better at enforcing privacy controls, access controls, provisioning controls, so that if somebody moves into a new role, they no longer need access to their old data. They can privacy, the IT team can cut that off. It's more likely that you'll do better at that if you have a centralized, well-staffed IT team than just Joe the IT guy or Sue the IT woman, who is a different one in every single office and has too much to do. And even, you know, one that's closer to home for compliance people, you could have a centralized compliance function that reports up to a chief compliance officer at headquarters, who then reports to the CEO or the board. Let's remember that when Walmart had its big FCPA trouble a decade ago, that came about because it had local compliance people answering to local general counsels who answered to local business chiefs around the world, and that became the channel for corruption to infect Walmart and cost it a tremendous amount of money. And one of the big reforms that Walmart did was it centralized its compliance function. So there are different ways that you can do that. But Tom, back to your original point, I will never say corporate culture doesn't matter. I will never say training doesn't matter. I will say that it is only one part of a two-pronged process for success. And you must still be thinking through, do we have the right structure in place? Do we have the best structure in place to support all of these policies and procedures and keep the opportunities to violate them as low as possible? You can't have one working well without the other working well too.
Any ideas on how a company might test itself or pressure test itself, starting with the HR function, but maybe into more broadly as some of the topics you ended your blog post on? We had a great test sample as reported by this New York Times article, but how could a company maybe test to see if it's actually working at the local level?
Well, you know, that would depend on exactly what you want to test here. And, you know, I don't recommend that everybody go and conjure up 80,000 fake resumes or fake third parties and see what happens. Probably a bit overwhelming. I won't get into specific tests here. I would say that if a compliance team wants to try this, go find your internal auditor or some sort of audit advisory firm and tell them this is what you want to do, and then see what they could come up with. I think this is the sort of challenge that a good internal audit function would relish, because it's quite an interesting exercise to figure it out. But that is what they do. They look at controls, they figure out ways to test them to see if they work well, and if the controls don't, they come up with recommendations on how to make the controls work better. So I would say your first stop would be to call the internal audit team and say, this is what I want to try to test. How would I do it? But there are any number of ways you could try to test it. Maybe there are some pockets of your enterprise, if you're very large, that do work on a more centralized platform, and there are other parts that work on a more localized platform. Compare the two. See what happens. But, you know, there are various ways to test it. And I think, you know, as this experiment here shows, the results can be eye-opening.
Well, Matt, it was a fascinating exploration of not simply a New York Times reported article, how you can extrapolate that into compliance. And perhaps we can continue to explore this issue further down the road.
Thank you, Tom.
This is Tom Fox again. As I mentioned at the start of this podcast, our sponsor for the Compliance Podcast Network this month is Ethoco. Have you ever struggled with the ROI of your compliance program? Have you struggled with how to present your compliance program budget request to your chief financial officer? Well, I paired with Ethoco to help you in both of those. Ethoco has created an ROI compliance calculator, and I've written a white paper on the ROI of compliance. You can get those by going to the website listed on the show notes. I hope you will check it out. I hope you will use it, and I hope you let us know whether it helped you or not.
I'd like to tell you about the latest edition of the Compliance Podcast Network, the Compliance Tip of the Day, where
In 3 to 5 minutes, I give you a quick compliance tip that you can use to integrate, upgrade, and enhance your compliance program. Check it out on the Compliance Podcast Network.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.